Hey, and welcome to Forecast, a podcast about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, I'm talking with Piers Sellars from the Goddard Space Flight Center. It was an interview I'd been wanting to do for kind of a long time. And for me, anyway, I find it difficult to get motivated to invite people to come on the show. I guess it's some kind of a version of imposter syndrome where I kind of feel like, oh, why are they? Are they going to even be interested in coming on the show? And it takes me a while to get motivated to do it. And then I tend to send out like four or five invitations and have a whole huge backlog of interviews to edit. But it did take me a while to get motivated to not motivated. It did take me a while to get up the guts to invite Piers to come on the show. I finally did for reasons that I think will become apparent later on in the interview. I was a bit intimidated, I think, probably because he's one of the best-known people in the world for the kind of work that I used to do when I was an academic and in grad school. I never met him before, and in a way, this is kind of like having a relative that you've heard about for a long time. I went to school with Steve Running, and Steve and Piers kind of did fairly similar things in a lot of ways. And so I was really thrilled to be able to talk to him, and he's just the nicest guy imaginable and completely genuine and interesting. As a scientist, Piers made really fundamental progress, I think, in three areas. Biosphere interactions, specifically modeling and bringing biology into climate models. Working with Compton Tucker on remote sensing of plant productivity at the global scale. And then developing and kind of running massive field campaigns to try and tie this all together. And really, any one of those could have been the foundation of a successful career. And he did all three of those before leaving to go to become an astronaut. Yeah, an astronaut for 15 years. So that was his second successful career. And then finally coming back to run a huge operation at NASA, both federal employees and a massive army of contractors. So again, he's had three major careers, each of which could have satisfied most people. So we talked through all that. And speaking of talking, one thing I've learned in doing these podcasts is that the number of ways in which things can go wrong on that technical level is pretty breathtaking. In this case, we were talking over Skype, and I use a call recorder to get an audio version of these calls. But we began in video just to kind of say hello. And then we turned off the video so we'd have the bandwidth available just to do a good quality audio recording. But what I didn't realize is that when you do that, the call recorder keeps thinking it's in video mode, which means that the audio portion of that is just horrendous, essentially unusable. Fortunately, Piers's PR person on his side had a digital recorder going, and she shipped me the audio recording. And Piers's end of it is pretty decent. My end was borderline unintelligible. So what I've had to do is I've re-recorded all of my audio, which means that what you're hearing now is not actually exactly what Piers heard. It's very close, and I tried to do a pretty good job of encapsulating what I did say in the conversation, but I just wanted to let you all know that in the cause of transparency. I hope you enjoy the show, and as always, the opinions expressed here are mine, and those are my guests. Thanks. Piers Sellars from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Piers, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. How are you?
You're now running a major NASA research facility and managing hundreds of employees. But you started out in rural southern England at a place called the Cranbrook School. What was that like?
Okay, let's rewinding the tape quite a long way. So my dad was in the army, British Army. So because of that, we got sent back to boarding schools. And so I was in boarding school from the age of seven. And, you know, the grammar school, which is like the high school boarding school I went to, was Cranbrook, which was a delightful little place. The best thing about it was they had really wonderful teachers in maths, physics, biology. These guys, you know, I owe them a huge debt because they really got me interested in science from the get-go. Now, the other thing that was going on when I was sort of 13-year-old at Cranbrook was the whole business of the space race was going on in the background. And I watched this absolutely fascinated, you know, as the Russians and the Americans duked it out to see who could get to the moon first. Followed every step, and it completely inspired me. So I went to my teachers and say, how do I get to do that? And they said, well, you better study some maths and physics. And then, and some biology wouldn't hurt either. And so I did, and it turned out that I found the real love of my life, which was science. Thank you, everybody at Cranbrook, for that. That was great.
I initially hadn't been planning on going so far into your background with Cranbrook, but in reading about it, I learned that you brought into space the school charter. And I'm just curious about your motivation for that. Was it because the school made such a big impression on you, or had the school asked for the charter to go into space?
That's right. Well, I wrote to them and said, look, I'm going to go into space. Is there anything you'd like me to take along that, you know, there's a very small chance you won't get it back? but all things going well, you'll have something to have gone to space and back. So they sent me the charter, and it was signed by Elizabeth I in 15-something. And it says, I hereby institute Cranbrook School in Kent for the good of the poor children of Cranbrook. So there you are. I'm one of the poor children of Cranbrook. So I took the charter up, brought it back, and it's now back safely in its frame in the school.
Amazing. I thought it would be a copy of a charter, but they actually sent you into space with the physical original charter of the school.
I think it might have been a copy. I've got a feeling that they were hedging their bets.
Soon after that, you went on to the University of Edinburgh, where you study what sounds like ecology. Was it kind of a straightforward ecology program, or did it also involve computational sciences?
It was pretty much a straightforward ecology course. It grew out of a forestry department. You know, it gave me the foundations of things that I wanted to know about photosynthesis, basically how, you know, ecosystems work and all that stuff. And right towards the end of the course, we started to getting into computational models, you know, little mathematical models of how systems work. Just a little bit of that. It was quite broad ranging. And as a result of that, I thought, I think the next step for me is to try and study climate systems and how, you know, the biosphere affects that. And that's what led to my PhD. So it was a nice stepping stone. Very interesting.
I'm not even sure of the exact timeline, but were models like the Jarvis model of stomatal conductance even around at the time, or was that a bit later?
Only just. In fact, Jarvis was my professor for my last year. He was the head of department for my last year in Edinburgh. So he was very influential on me. You know, he was the first guy that I remember meeting that was talking about, let's try and apply mathematics to biological systems, you know, in a really rigorous way. And he had this little model of stomatal conductance. That got my attention. And then I got to work with him later on as a colleague in the Boreas Field campaigns in northern Canada. So it was great fun to go full circle. I had my revenge.
Are you implying that Paul Jarvis was a difficult advisor?
Oh, no. He was a tough grader, no question. He's a very outspoken guy. We all said he'd been in Australia for a long time, and that was why. But, you know, he was terrific, a really good scientist and, you know, sorely missed by the rest of us now.
And then at that point, you must have gotten more heavily involved in the computational aspects of ecology and climate science because you were working partially at the UK Met Office and partially at Leeds. How did that part of your work expand over time?
Those two institutions, you know, sponsored me, and I got paid to do my PhD, which is wonderful, by the Natural Environmental Research Council in the UK. Actually, it was a very nice mixture. The UK Met Office were very helpful in getting me started in doing computer simulation work. And then back at Leeds, I put together a model which, you know, had basically a model of vegetation interacting with a lower atmosphere. Quite detailed model. And in there went the Jarvis stomatal conductance model, by the way, you know, a bit modified, but it went straight into that model. But I dealt with all the other aspects of things, you know, how sunlight radiation interacts with canopies, how the turbulence works in canopies, and all, you know, with the wind flowing over it and all the rest of it. So it was a complete model of surface atmosphere interactions.
Single column model?
Single column model. And I put different vegetation types in there to see the impact of changing vegetation type on the lower atmosphere.
I guess at this point, it couldn't have been a full three-dimensional canopy turbulence model.
No, it was pretty simple turbulence model, but I had a coniferous forest, I had a deciduous forest, and a wheat field, and grass. That was it.
Was it Penman Monteith for the fluxes or something else?
It was full-up stomatal conductance multi-layer model. So it's Penman Monteith done with multiple layers. So I was looking particularly at, you know, interception loss. That's the rainfall that falls on the leaves and then evaporates off again. That was something that was a bit of a mystery back then, you know, which was around 1980 when I was working on it. So I worked hard on that to see if we could make some progress in it. And we did. It was a lot of fun. You know, my PhD was doing a lot myself for the last couple of years, but terrific fun. I learned a lot about coding and a lot about programs and all the rest of it. Really enjoyed it.
After your PhD, it looks like you spent some time exploring the private sector, working as a consultant with BP Minerals. How did that arise, and how did you decide that that wasn't the path for you?
Well, you know, looking for a job when the money ran out, and I finished my PhD. So it was a scientific computing consultancy. Sycon was the name of the company, and they were a subsidiary of BP. So I ended up helping BP look for minerals around the world for nearly a year. But the fun part of it is I was living in London with my girlfriend at the time, who became my wife, and my brother and his girlfriend. We all lived in a flat in Islington. We had a wild year, you know. I mean, I basically ended up, we all ended up at the end of the year poorer than we started, but we had a great time. And then sort of out of the blue during that year, I got a phone call from NASA saying, hey, we've read your thesis. Would you like to come out for a postdoc in Goddard? And sort of a couple of months before that phone call, I had applied to another bit of NASA for the same postdoc. So we all got together and I got invited to come over in, I think, October 1982 to start, you know, as a NASA postdoc in Goddard Space Flight Center. First time I'd been to America. I flew to America with my wife on a Friday and started work on a Monday. It was, you know, and so the adventure began.
So your 1 year bohemian debauch in Islington came to an abrupt end, and you were launched right into suburban Washington.
That's right. It was a little bit quieter, but conducive to work. How about that?
Did you live in D.C. or did you live out near Goddard?
No, I live right outside the fence. You know, we got a house right outside the fence from Goddard. So I had, I think, a 2-minute, 15-second commute, timed it nicely for my meetings. We had a tiny, tiny little house there right outside Goddard and raised the two kids there. It was good.
I guess the area around Goddard isn't really known for being a hotbed of cultural diversity.
Hey, all the cultural diversity is in Goddard. The good news is it's inside the fence, man. I think 30% of our postdocs are from somewhere else, you know, not from the U.S. You know, that's how I got into the program, right? I was a U.K. citizen at the time. So 30% of our postdocs are from somewhere else. I think the proportion of foreign-born people in the Science and Exploration Division, which I'm part of, it's something like 20%, I think, foreign-born people. We've got people from all over the world, all attracted like moths to the flame of science, I tell you.
You must have been in your mid to late 20s when you arrived. Is that about right?
I was 27 when I showed up, and one of the first people I met was Compton Tucker, you know, one of my best friends. And you know, later on in the story, we'll find out that I lived in his basement for a year and a half, and then bought the house next door to him, and now I'm his next door neighbor. But Tucker was working on trying to look at vegetation dynamics from space. He was using a meteorological satellite that had an instrument for really looking at clouds. He was able to detect chlorophyll by getting rid of the clouds with the same instrument.
From the AVHRR.
AVHRR, that's right. And so he was looking at annual global scale ecology. This was a first. I was blown away. Working with him, I got pulled into the whole theory of what does this mean, this vegetation index that Tucker was seeing. We know it gets greener in the green bits and it's not green in the deserts and all the rest of it, but what does it really mean? And we figured out after a couple of years of wrestling with the equations that basically you're looking at photosynthetic power. You're looking at the capacity of the surface to do photosynthesis. From there, hey, take it away. We came up with the first global scale estimate of photosynthesis that was actually based on reality, based on observations. By using the vegetation index data from space for the whole world, you're able to calculate photosynthesis for the whole world.
I think that discovery that NDVI is actually a pretty good estimate of global photosynthesis, for me anyway, is one of the most remarkable scientific discoveries of the past several decades. It's kind of on the same level for me as other things that you can't imagine they would possibly work, like airplanes, for example, but they do really work. And you can understand why they work in retrospect, but at the time, it must have been kind of a combination of an amazing intellectual revolution, but also really focusing on the details. And I'm curious, looking back, when you and Compton were working on this together, did you appreciate the magnitude of what it was that you were able to show with this? Or was it not that apparent at the time?
It crept up on us, I'll be honest. You know, first of all, we were down in the weeds of trying to figure out sort of at the plot scale or at the leaf scale, how a plant does photosynthesis. And then what does it look like from a satellite sensor's point of view and how are those two things correlated? So we banged away at the mathematics of that for a while and, you know, published three papers. You know, Compton was on all of them, of course. Canopy reflectance, photosynthesis, transpiration, 1, 2, and 3. And basically we nailed it. We made the link between the most sophisticated photosynthetic model available right now. It's, you know, written by Joe Berry and Graham Farquhar, which works at the chloroplast level, okay? Down at the chloroplast level, it's a tiny little thing, the little green thing in the middle of a leaf. And we managed to figure out how to integrate that process you mentioned that a canopy of trees or a forest or whatever is like a cloud of chloroplasts. It's like a fuzzy green cloud of chloroplasts. We found a way to integrate that up through the depth of the canopy and over wider areas and link that directly to what the satellite was seeing, and bingo, out drops the answer. You have photosynthesis for a satellite pixel, and then you just integrate up for the whole world over the seasons and all the rest of it.
I feel like since then, and I'm sure that I'm completely exaggerating, but it seems like the field has been mostly figuring out the details since those early discoveries that you and Compton make, and that, well, it's incredibly important to understand how this slew of different sensors operates and the effects of viewing geometry and things like this, that the basic phenomenon that you can do this with remote sensing has been just incredibly robust over the years.
I think it's true. I mean, Compton and I, you know, it was great that we bumped into each other in the halls of Goddard, because, you know, he brought to it the whole knowledge of the satellite data, and then he was looking at the dynamics of this stuff changing, you know, worldwide and different parts of the world looking different and the seasons and all the rest of it. I came to it with basically the math and the, you know, analysis to try and figure out coming up from the bottom, if you like, from the bottom up, from what does it look like from a chloroplast point of view. And we met in the middle. It was one of the most fruitful, you know, intellectual collaborations I've ever had. You know, a lot of other people were involved too. Joe Berry and a whole bunch of other people were involved in the thinking. It was great fun. And then, by the way, we had to prove to ourselves that we weren't fooling ourselves, and that led to the field experiments, which I think you're probably going to talk about next.
Yes, absolutely. Before we get there, though, I'm curious about your work in the context of the physiology and working with Compton on the remote sensing and collaborations with people like Joe Berry and Graham Farquhar, and how that line of research was going on with the simultaneous work that was going on in the atmospheric modeling community, where, of course, there really wasn't much of a biosphere. So you were developing the biospheric side of it, and others were developing the atmospheric side of it. How did those two fields merge? Was it simultaneous, or did it take place over a longer time period?
It was kind of parallel development and ping-ponging between the business of thinking about satellite data and thinking about climate models. I was actually brought over in my postdoc to put a land surface model inside the climate model that was operating here in Goddard. So what I did was I wrote the first version of the simple biosphere model. It took a lot of ideas from my PhD thesis, including Jarvis's stomatal conductance model, which is a very, very empirical model. It was some steps back from the whole business of how photosynthesis controls transpiration. So I put that thing together in about 1986, and Batts and Sib had, you know, a number of similarities. Batts was Dickinson's model, had a number of similarities. We actually collaborated on some areas which we used in both of our models. But it wasn't until SIB 2, which came along a bit later, where we put all the business of tying biology, the latest photosynthetic model, which is based on enzyme kinetics and radiative transfer and all the rest of it, putting that in and linking it to the satellite data and having the satellite data define not only the photosynthetic power of vegetation, but also, you know, how it interacts with turbulence, with wind, and how it interacts with radiation, all coming, you know, feeding from the satellite data. So SIB2 is sort of a much more rigorous, biologically based, physically based model than SIB, but you got to start somewhere, right?
For the kind of work that you and your colleagues have been doing now for decades, I think that now people kind of take it for granted that you have to be doing more than one thing. You have to be doing the remote sensing, the modeling, but also major field campaigns. But when you got going on this, most ecology was done at the plot level, not at these massive scales, like you worked through in the Fife, Boreas, and LBA campaigns. Can you talk about where the need for these sort of campaigns arose and how it affected the kind of work that you were doing, any kind of insights that immediately came out of that sort of work?
That's an excellent question, and I'm glad I had a chance to think about it before you asked me, because I was trying to reconstruct events a bit. So I showed up in the U.S. in 1982. In 1983, the next year, went to a workshop where the great and the good, including Dickinson, by the way, who's a great friend and mentor, were all gathered there. And first of all, we all agreed that the current land surface models in global circulation models, the current land surface bit was very, very poorly done. And it was giving really bad results. Among other things, it was, screwing up rainfall calculations over the continents. That's true for weather prediction models as well as climate models. So the land surface modeling was in a terrible state. So we all agreed we've got to do better than that. And I just started thinking about SIB then, and Dickinson was thinking about his model BATS. And we said, you know, one of the problems is that we don't really know how the land surface, you know, interacts with the atmosphere on a reasonably large scale, on a scale that matters to a climate model, you know, kilometers rather than a few meters. So that was the first thing. The second thing is, why don't we try and use satellite data to initialize and validate, you know, the land surface component in climate models? Why don't we use satellite data to help us figure out albedo, you know, reflectance? Why don't we use it to try and figure out greenness? That was a very early thought. The question was asked in 1983. And so we came to the conclusion that what we needed to do was to have a field campaign on a big enough scale that would be relevant to a climate model. So we chose a 10 by 10 kilometer square in glamorous Kansas. That was the Fife experiment. And we had people measuring things on the ground with a very carefully worked out statistical sampling system. So they're measuring things like absorb radiation, evaporation rates, and carbon dioxide uptake rates. And also right down to the leaf scale, these guys were working on the ground. Then we had a fleet of 8 aircraft, all the way from helicopters and low-flying aircraft measuring things up to a U-2 at 60,000 feet, looking at different scales at the same plot. And we timed all of this to happen, you know, very intensely when the satellites came over, Landsat and the AVHRR instrument on the NOAA satellite and the French satellite Spot. So you get these snapshots where you have 300, you know, 150 people beavering away in Kansas on the ground, 8 aircraft buzzing around, all stacked up in a column, and then the satellite comes flying over at 5 miles per second. Snap! Takes a picture. And we figured out, and we proved to ourselves in the Fife experiment, that what we understood at the leaf level translated to the multi-kilometer level and could be compared with a satellite observation hundreds of kilometers up, flying at 5 miles per second. It all made sense. We proved to ourselves that we could fill in this gap on the road to doing global ecology. It was a great moment. It was a great moment. This was 1987 and 1989.
This then must have been the first time that the processes you knew operated at the molecular and leaf level and should in theory scale up to the broader kind of climate model pixel scale actually did scale up at that resolution.
That's right. The first time. We put it all together in one go. And, you know, one of the challenges of the experiment was we had to have field botanists and plant physiologists working with atmospheric correction and flux people, working with aircraft people, working with satellite data people, working with climate model people. And it really threw us all together and started a community revolution, really, in interdisciplinary science. It was a very exciting phase. We basically leapfrogged a whole generation of modeling effort by having this very intense 3-year experience altogether, from really, really bad land surface models to something quite sophisticated 4 years later that was driven by satellite data and was entirely credible. It was a revolution.
You've been involved in, at this point, a lot of field campaigns. You began with a comparatively simple canopy in terms of its biological diversity and also probably the roughness characteristics in Kansas. But then the community saw a need to move on to a somewhat more complicated canopy and ecosystem in the boreal forest. We have a little bit more floristic diversity, but also a lot more variation in the canopy roughness. And ultimately, moving into the tropics, which is at the complete other end of the extreme from Fife, so LBA being vastly more complicated. As the community moved from this relatively simple canopy structure towards this much more complex structure, did the answer fundamentally change?
Well, you know, I was heavily involved in the design and management of Fife. Same thing for Boreas. In that case, in Boreas in Canada, it was pretty tough. We chose this region in central Canada because the models told us that the greatest rate of climate change on the continents would take place in the middle of Siberia and the middle of Canada, you know, where the warming would progress most rapidly. So that's why we chose the Boreas sites as the target. It was very ambitious compared to Fife. Fife was a 10 by 10 kilometer square. Boreas were two big sites, each about 100 by 50 kilometers, separated by about 600 kilometers in the northern and southern edges of the boreal forest. We had like 300 people running around there, 11 aircraft, and a lot more satellites to work with. But again, you know, fundamentally, we proved the same thing to ourselves, that we could use the satellite data to scale across these huge regions. I got involved in the early design of the LBA campaign in Amazonia. but I left to join the astronaut corps in 96 before that entered the field phase. So, you know, I tromped around Amazon fighting snakes and mosquitoes and all the rest of it, but I didn't get to actually participate in the field campaign. But all my friends did, so they had fun.
I think it was early in my own career in grad school when I first heard about your interest in joining the astronaut program. I was up at the Boreas Field site, and there was always this talk about, oh, Peter Sellers is going to join the astronaut program. He's off to the program. I know you've had a long-term interest in space exploration, going back to your days at Cranbrook. Had this interest kind of just been burbling along through the years, or was there something else that was a more proximate that drove you to apply to the program?
Well, I've always thought the whole business of manned space flights fascinating. Like I said, I grew up during the Apollo era, which was, I thought the whole thing was completely heroic and wonderful, and thought I'd love to do that. So I never closed the door on the opportunity. I applied whenever there was an opening, and I got lucky. Third time lucky, right? So in 96, they said, come down, you better be here in 10 weeks in Johnson Space Center to start work. And it was right at the end of the second lot of Boreas field campaigns. So it was a good time to basically switch out.
How does one even go about applying for the astronaut program?
Go out and fill out a lot of forms. And for all of you would-be applicants out there, it's very important to fill out the forms correctly. That's part of the test. Can you fill out a form accurately and correctly?
Do they make the process intentionally difficult and obtuse because the people who can successfully get through that are possibly the same people who would do well at filling out a proper pre-flight checklist?
Well, they don't make it deliberately lengthy. I mean, all the forms have purpose and importance in the selection. They really do, because I've been on the other side of the fence, you know, working this astronaut selection process. So all that stuff is relevant. But you want to know a lot about whoever it is, you know, about he or she. You know, what they've got to offer and their motivations and what kind of person they are. Are they a good team player? Are they an egomaniac or a psychopath? You know, you need to know all this. You need to know this stuff. Forms really help, you know, so you plow through all the paperwork. But to be an astronaut, you know, do your job properly, yeah, you have to be disciplined about things like checklists and documentation. You have to know the importance of, you know, the paper. It's just like flying aircraft. You don't just walk up to an aircraft and jump in it without looking at, hey, is this aircraft safe? Is it certification and date? Is there anything on the squawk list I should worry about? And, oh, by the way, where's the checklist and what's the weather? So, you know, the preparation, the paperwork, you know, the discipline to do that properly, it's sort of somewhat akin to filling out forms accurately.
This seems completely idiotic on my part, but I never thought of spaceflight as being heroic exploration, perhaps in the tradition of previous British explorers of places like Antarctica.
I think that might have been in the background a little bit. I mean, we were always taught as kids to look up to people like Shackleton. But, you know, the thing about Shackleton is our school teachers always used to say to us, it was not just what he did, because he didn't actually get to the South Pole, right? It was his leadership and the fact that he looked after his people so well. And he didn't lose a man on the great disaster when he lost his ship. And they all had to sit on the ice and then sit on an island and then do this epic voyage across the Southern Ocean to South Georgia to get help. I mean, the whole business when you read the story about Shackleton was not so much that he was a guy who put a flag in the pole, because he didn't, but he was such an inspiring leader. That was a message I think that people were trying to get across to us little British school kids.
As an astronaut, you went to the International Space Station, I think, three times and had a total of something like six individual missions. When you're up there, you must have had a perspective that wasn't totally dissimilar from that which would have been used by the satellites that were in use in things like the Boreas and 5 campaigns and in your global remote sensing with Compton. Once you're up in space, did you have any kind of a change in your perspective on your own previous work as a research scientist?
Absolutely. So I did three space flights to ISS. And, you know, I was involved in the early, middle, and late assembly phases of the station. And I was a spacewalker, so I did six long spacewalks, which were to do with either installation or repair of big chunks of space station. So I spent a lot of time outside the ship fixing it up. So they worked us pretty hard at that. But now and again, they would say, hey, stand by. We got to go and safe some electrical box before you can go and mess with it. So you got 4 minutes of nothing. And they're very good about that. And so you had 4 minutes to look around. when you're in the shuttle or the space station, look out a window, it's like looking through a little window into an aquarium, you know, one of those little pressure windows into an aquarium. But when you're in a spacesuit, you know, you're looking through your visor, you are in the aquarium, man. You're outside the spacecraft, clambering around, and you're in the environment. And if you lean your face forward into the visor, you can't see the edges of your helmet. So it's like, just like being there. It's just you're hanging in space on this great gleaming machine that's hurtling around the planet. Black sky, white sun. The white sun is moving. You can see it move. You can see the shadows moving on station. You're going so fast. And then you look down at the Earth, and this is the really good bit. It's beautiful. It's absolutely breathtaking. So all the things that I'd studied in theory and seen static images of, like a hurricane, I could actually see for myself with my own eyes. You can see over 1,000 miles in every direction. So it's a total God's eye view of the Earth. And I did learn a few things. First thing I learned was that, wow, the atmosphere is really thin compared to the size of the Earth. It's like an onion skin. So that brought home to me, it's such a small volume. It's no wonder that whatever we do, our 7 billion people do, it's no wonder we're affecting it. It's a tiny, tiny volume. It only goes 3 times higher than the tops of the tallest clouds that you can see, effectively. There's not much there. So that banged that home to me. And then the other thing was that I could see the hand of man, if you like, everywhere. What mankind is doing, good and bad, all around the world. You know, the good thing I saw, of course, is you fly around the night side and you see all the cities. And you see how beautifully they're grafted onto the landscape, around bays, on coasts and in valleys, and how they're kind of almost organically integrated into the landscape. And you think, God, there's all these people down there doing something. The great cities that, you know, us humans have put up, they're the source of all the creativity that you see around it. You know, you have to have lots of people working, living close together to make good things happen. And they do. So that was the good part. Obviously, we saw the bad part too, which is big forest fires here and there, land clearances, and huge patches of smog over some of the industrial regions. But it did make me feel how humans are an integral part of this whole system.
I think if I'd been up there, I probably would have reached a different conclusion looking down at the city lights. I think I would have felt that the presence of humans was absolutely everywhere, and that this wasn't necessarily a good thing. But from your perspective, it seems like it gave you this perception that humans aren't separate from the planet. They're really just part of it. And I'm curious as to whether or not this was a new insight for you, or if this had been part of your worldview all along.
That was a new feeling I got when I was up there. You know, when you leave home, you like it better because you're away from there and your mom isn't cooking for you and all the rest of it. When I left home, when I left the planet, I became much fonder of it. So I guess I became much fonder of the planet, including all the people who live there, who are an integral part of it. I mean, the fate of the planet really is bound up with what humans are going to do. So the combination of us and our home, I'm fond of it all. Want to see the best outcome for the planet and for humans.
Looking at your publication record, it kind of appears that you managed somehow to stay active scientifically even when you were in the astronaut program.
Not really, man. I managed to make a fresh start on only one significant science paper in my whole 15 years in the astronaut office. And that was written in 15-minute increments at the kitchen table at night. I had to let go of a lot. I mean, being an astronaut is a 1.5 full-time job. So it pretty much sucked me in. But I kept in touch with my science friends as much as I could. I used to go and visit with them and talk about science. I tried to keep up with all the stuff that they were doing, not terribly successfully.
So it sounds like the astronaut program was equally as absorbing as being a scientist, but in a completely different way. One of the big appeals for science for me has always been that you can pursue within certain constraints pretty much any idea that you want to pursue. So, for example, I think about the kind of work that Tucker does. He might be going in one topic, but then he gets interested in the issue of Ebola and climate interactions because that's important at the moment, and he can just go and do that immediately. Whereas I imagine when you're an astronaut, your future over the months and years is much more tightly constrained, but probably no less absorbing.
Right. So Tucker and I had slightly different career paths in in Goddard when we were scientists. Tucker's was running a little group there. You know, we actually became quite a big group that was doing all the satellite data processing. I was doing the modeling with a climate group. So I was interacting with a very large group there. And then, of course, the land surface experiments, the field experiments with lots and lots of people. So I was creeping towards being science management as well as being a scientist, which Tucker cleverly and carefully avoided, as he keeps reminding me. But I liked it, so you know, that's all right. The business of being, you know, in national office, you are scheduled, you know, dawn to dusk with things to do. And then, by the way, then there's the study and background reading. So in a very short time, for example, we have to learn how to fly a little fighter jet, got to learn everything about space station, everything about space shuttle. By the way, learn Russian too, so that you can talk to your Russian friends, and then learn about all the other international partner pieces of space station, because they're a bit different from your part. So it was a lot of work. The schedulers were terrific. They basically lashed us from one event to another.
Would you say then that the life of an astronaut is perhaps less existential than that of a scientist, and a bit more proximate, but just no less interesting?
It's no less interesting, but as an astronaut, basically, or an operator, you're in the operational environment all the time. Your job is to thoroughly understand what you're doing. You have a huge team behind you on the ground, and they want you to do something. And your job is to use all your training and all their knowledge to do the job as safely, quickly, and correctly as possible. So fundamentally, you're an operator. You're not required to ponder original thoughts about how to do something. That's not the case. Somebody else has done that for you. Your job is to be a flawless operator, or as flawless as you can be. Whereas a scientist, you know, hey, you're experimenting and making mistakes and errors, and correcting them is part of the fun and part of the process. You know, a scientist who's afraid to make a mistake is not going to be much of a scientist, right? You'd never get anywhere. So it's a very different mindset. I enjoy them both and I respect them both. My respect for engineers went through the roof, having gone through the whole astronaut experience for 15 years, and the engineering community, the way that they do business and the way they work as teams. You know, I really grew to respect that a lot.
After working as an operator for 15 years, did you find yourself chafing to get back into science, or were there other things going on that brought you back to NASA science, or is the tenure of an astronaut simply fixed?
I could have stayed there. There are a couple of things that I could have taken a run at doing a 6 months on station, which would have been very gratifying and a lot of fun. But I had three fantastic space flights. And I was looking at all these young guys and gals in the astronaut office who were in line and waiting. And I thought, you know, if I take another slot, one of those people is not going to get one. And I knew how that felt, because when I joined the astronaut office, there was some of that feeling going around. So it was great. I had three wonderful flights, wonderful experience. I was really, really excited about the science that was going on. It was a perfect time to leave and come back to Goddard as a bureaucrat.
I can imagine that your 15 years as an operator was fantastic preparation for what you're doing now. If I have this right, you're the deputy director of the Science and Exploration Directorate, as well as the acting director of the Earth Science Division. And it sounds like an absolutely overwhelming job to have both of those at the same time.
Yeah.
Now you're managing hundreds of NASA scientists as well as thousands of contractors. How was that transition coming back from the astronaut program to a place where you'd been a research scientist for so many years?
Right. Well, so, you know, I'd only managed in the field campaign as, you know, I was managing for periods a couple, 200-300 people, something like that. Not managing their everyday lives, just managing their operations during the field campaigns. And then in Johnson, I managed the space station branch. So it was all the astronauts who were flying to space station. So, you know, I was managing about 40 people there. That's not very much, right? So when you go from that to being the deputy of a directorate that's got 2,500 people, and then the Earth Science Division, which is 1,500 people, yeah, it was a big jump in scale, but I hung out with smart people who basically taught me a lot about executive management, which is, you know, something you need to know to do this, and steep learning curve. But I enjoyed it immensely, and we have a wonderful team here, particularly in our science division, where I spend most of my time. We have a wonderful bunch of people doing the work, a wonderful bunch of people managing the people who do the work. The whole enterprise is basically, you know, what do I do? My job is to make sure that they get the resources and the encouragement to do the best they can as quickly as they can. And that's what we do.
One of the main challenges that a lot of academics face as they go into their first roles as a professor is that they're thrust into roles for which they have little or no training, in particular things like teaching and mentoring and financial management. But it sounds like when you came back to Goddard, there was at least some kind of an effort or some kind of program training efforts to give you the skills that you needed to deal with this vastly expanded managerial role. Did that happen, or was it really just trial by fire?
It's trial by fire for the most part. And to be honest, most of the things that I've done in my life, you learn most by doing and hanging out with people who are masters at the trade that you're getting into. And that's everything that I've done from flight instruction, astronaut, science, and manager. All those things, basically go in and do it and hang out with a person or people who know how to do it and listen to them. You know, I think formal coursework for management, for example, I put much less value on that than actually trying to do the job as best you can, being transparent, and listening to smart people.
When I look at the kind of work that comes out of NASA, I see two major threads that are, of course, intimately linked. But one thread is the technical development of things like sensors and algorithms. And the other major thread, of course, is the development of question-based science. For example, trying to tackle this ongoing and seemingly never-ending issue of the Amazonian response to drought. Now, with your overview as a manager of this vast horde of people working in NASA on these kinds of topics, what's your perspective? Do you have the ability now in a managerial role to try and adjust the knobs on the institution to favor one or the other? Or do you try to just give people the space to pursue their more natural inclinations?
Well, actually, you know, our little management team is taking a giant mole wrench, put it on the knob, and trying to give it a large crank to the right, in the sense that we're trying hard to integrate the whole business of thoughts about missions, mission scope, with the science questions. It all starts with the science, but quite often the scientists can wander off into their own area where they get involved in, you know, answering a scientific question, sit at their desks, and don't spend enough time talking to the engineers and the instrument scientists who say, hey, I've got a widget that I think might be able to take an important measurement here. I'll give you an example of like a little technical miracle, which still, you know, I'm in awe of. And that's the gravity mission, GRACE, which goes around measuring little wiggles in the Earth's gravity field. And then, you know, we have a bunch of scientists who are looking at this and working with the engineers, and they figure out that they can track the rate of ice loss over Greenland through melt. They can see the Greenland ice cap melting and sliding off into the Atlantic by the change in the gravity field. I mean, to me, this is pretty much a technical miracle.
It is.
So a scientist would always be saying, I wonder how much ice is melting around the world. Would it have occurred to them in any other environment than NASA to team up with a bunch of people who are trying to measure little gravity wiggles to take that measurement and get those insights? So, you know, you have to keep the communication going between the engineering technical side and the science side.
And probably nowhere better in the world to do this than at NASA.
NASA, I think, is absolutely the best place in the world for doing it, which is why I came back here.
How then do you make the connection to the academic community, which wouldn't have the same kind of day-to-day connection with the engineering community? Do they have to kind of just fend for themselves?
No, basically, you know, NASA's got a long tradition of drafting, coercing, cajoling academics to come into the mix. And we have a lot of academic PIs, you know, principal investigators on some of our instrument projects, and many, many academic PIs on the science research and analysis side. So there's a healthy interchange between the NASA core and the sort of academic diaspora. But without the core, you don't get anything done. Frankly, you've got to have this core group of engineers and scientists co-located, talking to each other all the time to make progress in the area. And the scientists add, you know, out there in the universities, add tremendous science depth to the bench. But you need an institution like NASA to provide the glue to pull the whole enterprise together.
One of the main themes of climate modeling research, not just in your own work, but more broadly, has been the ongoing effort to try and introduce biology or the biosphere into the climate models. In your current position, looking forward, let's say for the next few years, do you see the biospheric development as still being a core area of research? Or when you think about trying to provide policy relevant and societally relevant climate modeling from NASA, what do you see as being the major areas of research?
Well, I think that the NASA modeling effort, climate and weather prediction, we do both here in this division. You know, we've got the GIS model, which is a full-up climate model that's on a par with the other sort of 20-odd climate models around the world. And we have Global Modeling and Simulation Office here in Greenbelt that's, 150 people in that unit. They're looking at ways to do much better weather prediction and seasonal prediction, things like El Niños and stuff like that, short-term stuff. It's all about model improvement. It's all useful to the public. And it's becoming increasingly a tool for decision-making for policymakers. So I think when you think about COP15 there in Paris, okay, so we don't have an agreement there that's got a lot of teeth to it, but it's a good start. But the best part about that COP15 climate agreement is that it's based on science. They set the 2 degrees centigrade limit as being the safe limit based on scientific advice. So that's a huge triumph, and NASA played a big part in that. And I think our role going forward is to keep an eye on the health of the planet, which we do with our satellites, and try and project forward in time using our models, what the impact of different energy policy options would be. So we got our work cut out for us. We're not in the business of making policy, but we are in the business of providing the facts and theories that help policymakers and the public decide what to do.
I hadn't realized that there is a scientific reason for the 2 degree threshold. I'd always thought of it as being more of a politically agreed and politically negotiated threshold. That was then interpreted through a scientific lens. But it sounds like you actually do feel that there is some scientific rationale to it.
I think that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they produce these telephone book-sized huge tomes on the state of the science, and then a little skinny summary for policymakers, which is pretty much all most people have time to read. 30 pages, good read, and 10 really good figures that tells you what's going on. When you look in that, it says, well, out to 2 degrees, we think we understand pretty well what the world will look like, and there'll be some changes, and some of them are going to be a little tricky to deal with. If you go to 3 degrees, you're looking at really severe changes. And 4 degrees, please let's not go there. It looks dangerous. So I think for policymakers, it was pretty clear from the science evidence, 2 degrees. Well, no one's going to argue about 2.1 or 1.9, right? You've got to have some easy to remember number. But 2 degrees, I think, is about right in terms of our model performance can tell us what a 2 degree world will look like.
The U.S. has a long tradition of isolationism and a sense of American exceptionalism, but also, at least in some quarters, kind of an anti-scientific bent to it, I think, is growing in some areas now. And at the same time, we have other pressing needs for investment in things like poverty reduction and combating HIV/AIDS globally and many other public health concerns like that. When you think about the slow progress that we've had in the U.S. to date, and also in other countries, do you think it's partially because of America's unique sense of its place in the world, or are there other factors at play? And then do you think that the Paris agreements will fundamentally change any of this?
Progress has been slow for many reasons. There's, obviously a reluctance to make major changes to the world's economic machine based on, a rumor or a hoax, as the early deniers said. But, I wrote an article recently in New York Times where I said, I think that 2015 is going to be remembered as the year of the death of denial. The deniers' arguments have basically run out of gas. The scientific evidence is absolutely overwhelming that the climate is changing and it's us humans that are doing it. And now the majority of Americans, about 70%, believe that the climate is changing. So the business of winning the scientific argument, I'm declaring that it's done. Discussion is over, and the deniers are pretty much in the camp of the sort of people who were defending tobacco use way back when. They're a very small, isolated group, cherry-picking data, and not very credible. So now you have policymakers, generally speaking, relying on the science, on the reported science, to help them make decisions. And I refer back to that COP15 agreement that we were just talking about. So I'm kind of hopeful that going forward, that the conversation between science and the public and policy and faith, too, because the Pope's had something to say about all this, will continue in a collegial way. I did like the way the Pope, by the way, you know, when he wrote his encyclical, he got the Vatican to thoroughly review all the climate science, you know, thoroughly understand it. And his declaration, you know, in the encyclical was a moral case about what we should do in terms of policy. Okay, that's the view of the Catholic Church. But it was entirely consistent with the facts. That's really interesting, where you have faith relying on science to help guide a moral argument. That's progress.
Other people like E.O. Wilson have been making related arguments from the moral perspective. And I think it's an incredibly positive development, because if you don't have people like the Pope and E.O. Wilson making these sorts of arguments, it's going to be really difficult for huge chunks of the population to have major buy-in to climate change.
That's right. You know, people listen to their leaders, whether they're political leaders or religious leaders, they listen very carefully. So the guidance that these leaders come up with is important, and the more it's based on science, the better.
In the same piece in the New York Times that you mentioned a moment ago, you also disclosed in this amazingly forthright and, for me, really moving way that you've recently been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. When you got the news, what was the immediate effect on you in terms of what you hope to do with the time you have left, both personally and professionally?
Well, yeah, the timing of all this was kind of interesting. It all happened in October, a week in October, the same week that my first grandchild was born, which was great. And then this news was a bit of a damper. But, you know, you've got to be philosophical about these things. So it made me concentrate immediately. What is it that I want to do? I don't have that much time, right? So what is it that I want to do in the next sort of year to 18 months, which is the time horizon that I have? And very quickly, you know, as I wrote in the article, very quickly I found out I didn't want to go on a mega tourist sweep of the world, exclusive beaches and, you know, photo ops and all the rest. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to spend more time with my family and my friends and the people I work with, who are a lot of my friends, by the way, because I spent 30 years hanging around with some of these jokers, and doing the work. The work is important. You know, I kind of realized all those cracks about, hey, the guy on his deathbed said, you know, I wish I'd spent less time at the office. I remember one of the early Apollo astronauts coming back saying, I'm not one of those guys. I loved being at the office. And I love being at the office. I love every day coming in here and finding out latest progress, talking to brilliant people, talking about exciting things. People are totally motivated and positive and hopeful and good. It's great. So I'm sort of redoubling my efforts to try and help the enterprise along. I'm spending more time with people I really like to be with, trying to live at 20 times normal rate.
I had a very minor melanoma. It was nothing at all like what you're going through. But when you do have something like that, you kind of get going reading a little bit about how people deal with cancer and the advice you get. And a lot of the advice you read about is something on the order of, you know, live every day to its fullest. And I sort of thought about that. And I think I would just, if I was drinking first growth Burgundies every day and going on 100-mile bike rides, which is what I'd be inclined to be doing, I would be sort of exhausted in a week. It doesn't even seem feasible. But I think that the real spirit of that advice is just to try and think carefully about what you want to do and to try and maximize the time that you do have available. For you, it seems like a lot of what you get out of life is from your professional activities. And so I'm wondering, in your time horizon, what are your professional goals?
Yeah, I mean, see, when you say professional, you know, to be honest, my professional and personal life, I can't tell where one stops and the other starts. And that's been true for the last 30 years. Both have been marvelous, and they both blur into each other. I regard work as being one of the most gratifying, interesting, fascinating, energizing things that I'm doing. And so that's why it takes up 3/4 of my time, at least. And the rest I sit around drinking and sleeping. So what is it that remains to be done? Okay, lots. The business of getting the models into shape so they can be really useful predictive tools, we've got a lot of work to do there, particularly on things like regional prediction. We're just finding out now that the models can actually do a pretty credible job of predicting things like, where are regional droughts likely to hit? in the latter part of this century. And guess what? The Dust Bowl in the North America and the Mediterranean basin are two prime targets for extended, serious, deep droughts. Something to worry about, something to plan for, something to check with models and experiments going forward. Next thing is, we need to continue taking satellite observations, so we've got to agitate to continue the satellite data records so that we can keep track of changes in things like the ice sheets and the forests and all that stuff. And then we've got to think about new missions that'll help us give us, you know, even more insights into what's going on. So there's a lot to be done. If it covers a range from helping a postdoc get going on a project and integrating them with a team, all the way up to having spirited discussions with people who control the money about what kind of mission we should be flying next.
I think something that's not really appreciated very much at all outside the community is that the amazing satellite data we have available doesn't just leap out of nowhere. These missions are individually fought for. They're extremely competitive. And even for the ones that are more like monitoring missions, things like Landsat, they're debated and there's no guarantee that they're going to continue into the future. And there are ongoing and very intense budget discussions around all of this.
The country spends $2 billion a year on environmental satellites, now, the civilian environmental satellites. By the way, it's a bargain. The benefits are obviously huge. Just hurricane prediction, you get your money back. So we spend $2 billion a year on hardware. Now, if you continue every single measurement that you've ever thought of and that you've done in the past, then you won't have any sea room to think of to do new missions. So it's a constant struggle to find ways to continue the important measurements, identify which ones they are, continue them, and look for cheaper ways to do it. And also think of cheaper, more flexible ways to do new science. It's a continuous struggle, continuous work, but basically we have technology working for us. Because as time goes by, things become more available and cheaper to do. And you can replace previous systems, you know, prototype systems, the first satellite up of its kind, generally with a cheaper successor as you go forward. But it's a lot of work to try and prioritize this. And, you know, in the next year or two, whole sort of science community, earth science community in the U.S. is going to be arguing about what to do next in the Earth Science Decadal Survey, it's called, that run by the Academy of Science. And that's going to give NASA advice onto what are the high priority measurements. So that's the big forum for making these decisions. But of course, there are all kinds of smaller fora where people discuss these things and think about them.
The main currency for any working scientist is always the strength of your ideas and the degree to which others find them to be interesting and compelling and worthy of further research and development. But now as an administrator, you're on the other side of the equation where I guess for you, the currency is a bit different. The currency now for you is the degree to which you can inspire others to pursue their own goals and dreams and inspirations. And when you think about what's inspiring the current young generation of scientists coming into NASA, are they inspired by the same kinds of questions, the same interest in societal relevance and climate and the future of the planet that drove forward the interest of you and your colleagues decades ago?
Hey, let me tell you that the people who are 30 plus years younger than me that were pulling in as postdocs, they're fantastic. I mean, these guys and girls are as committed and as fanatical about getting on with the job as we were all those years ago. So we have these town halls for our science division every sort of couple of months. And the last slide I always put up is the same slide, parting shots. And it says three things. One, you belong to the most capable civilian agency in the world. You can be very, very proud of that. Two, when you go on the road and go outside of NASA, remember who you represent. And please try and conduct yourself accordingly. And three, the work you are doing is more important than it ever has been before. So that's the credo. And I see young people coming into the fold being absolutely committed to it. Put it up there as a reminder to all of us, me included, of why we're doing what we're doing. But the young people, they take it on board and they're doing it.
Something I always think about in this kind of work is how the work proceeds and fits and starts. There are topics that you and your colleagues developed, you know, things like land atmosphere interactions or remote sensing of terrestrial plant productivity that were enormous advances. And then it's taken a long time to flesh out the details and to really understand the mechanisms and the processes and how it all works with different satellites and over time. When you interact with these passionate young scientists, what are some of the topics that they're working on that you think could be this kind of a topic for the next 30 years?
Well, there's a bunch of people thinking about trying to figure out where the carbon dioxide is being generated and where it's being absorbed. So we know that the atmosphere and the oceans take up about half the CO2 that we emit through industrial activities, but we don't really know where. Some of these young, smart people are coming up with all kinds of cool ideas, trying to figure that out. And, you know, it's very novel. I think the contributions over the next few years are going to be made by basically, you know, people who are postdocs or early career. You know, they've got access to all this hardware and clobber that's been accumulated over the last 30 years that's working very smoothly. And now it's a resource they sort of take for granted because, hey, it was there when they showed up, which is great, right? But they're going to take it to the next level. I'm absolutely sure of it.
Pierre Sellers from the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center has made some of the major advances in biosphere-atmosphere interactions. Remote sensing, was an astronaut for 15 years and now runs a major NASA operation. Pierce, thank you so much for your time today.
Michael, thanks a lot. That was a lot of fun.
That was my interview with Pierre Sellers from NASA. If you'd like to check out Pierce's extremely interesting and moving opinion piece in the New York Times, you can just simply Google Pierre Sellers New York Times. But if you want to go right to it, it's in the January 16th edition of the Times. And the piece is called Cancer and Climate Change. Huge thanks to Pierce for coming on the show in these circumstances. Thanks also to Compton Tucker, who I initially contacted to see if Pierce might be interested in doing this sort of thing, given what he's going through with the pancreatic cancer. So Compton, thanks a lot for your help getting this going. If you like this kind of discussion, one of the best ways you can try to help your friends and colleagues find it is through leaving a review on iTunes or on Stitcher, where the podcasts are hosted. If you want to send me an email with feedback, criticism, suggestion, you can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are at forecastpod.org. I'll talk to you soon.